Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
I've always loved history. It was my favorite course when I was in high school. I remember when I went to Arizona State University, I pursued a bachelor's degree in history because I thought I was going to become a high school history teacher. Now, life took a different direction, but that's okay. I still study history and I teach it when I talk about the history of the Bible or the history of the church. And even on the Council of Trent podcast, history comes up on our regular episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and also on Free for All Fridays. You'll get historical topics here from time to time. And today is no exception. Today, what I want to talk about on Free for All Friday is Holocaust denial. So why do I want to talk about that? Well, this week is actually Holocaust Memorial Week in April. And when I would do Justice for All pro-life exhibits on university campuses, we would go to these campuses, set up our pictures of abortion to have dialogue with students. There's a lot of times we would go to college campuses in April, and they would have Holocaust Memorial Week going on. And I remember in Colorado, there was one campus that had an exhibit in the Memorial Union, the University Union, with pictures of the Holocaust. So people would come up to us and say, "You shouldn't put these pictures of abortion up. They're graphic. They're disgusting. How dare you?" And I would say, "Well, in the Memorial Union, there are pictures of the Holocaust. There's pictures of bodies being pushed over by bulldozers and people who are victims of gas chambers. Why aren't you protesting that?" They said, "Well, it's different. That happened to actual people." Ah, so there's the issue then. And so that's what I want to talk about, though, is that most people recognize that the Holocaust is a legitimate historical occurrence, but not everybody. And so there's a growing group of people, and you can find a lot of them in the dark corners of the internet. And even people we may come in contact with in regular life are skeptical or even doubt that the Holocaust happened. But I will tell you this, if you don't know anybody in your life that feels this way, you go on the internet, you can find a lot of people in comment sections on Reddit and other places who embrace Holocaust denial. And somebody whose family is Jewish, whose family fled from persecution in Europe, in Russia, it's very hurtful and it's very scary to see. And it's something that deserves to be refuted. And in order to refute it, I was about to say deserves to be understood. It's a viewpoint that doesn't deserve anything except swift refutation. But in order to refute this, we have to understand it, because it does no good just to say, "Oh, those people are whack jobs. Don't listen to them." Because if we don't put forward good reasons to show why they're off base, other people will be taken in by that. So that's what I'm going to do today here on the Council of Trent podcast. What is Holocaust denial and how can we refute it? So very briefly, Holocaust denial usually involves at least one of the following claims. It's a claim that either Nazi Germany's final solution was only trying to deport Jews from Nazi Germany. They weren't trying to exterminate anyone. That the Nazis didn't use extermination camps or gas chambers. That people who died in camps died as prisoners of war, just like people die in prison camps all over the world. They said there's nothing unique about what happened in Nazi Germany versus prison camps in other parts of the world at that time. Or people who embrace Holocaust denial will say that the actual number of Jews who died in Nazi Germany was far lower than the figure of 5 to 6 million. They may say only like 500,000 died, and they died of starvation or disease. There was no plan for a mass execution. Deborah Lipstadt, who we'll discuss more as the program continues, has written wonderful works refuting Holocaust denial, and this is how she summarizes what Holocaust denial is.
Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. The only reason to deny the Holocaust is to inculcate and foster anti-Semitism.
The Holocaust has the dubious distinction of being the best documented genocide in the world. So for anybody to disbelieve, they've got to come to it with some sort of preconceived notion. Holocaust denial takes different forms. And I divide it into hardcore Holocaust denial and softcore Holocaust denial. Hardcore Holocaust denial is the argument made by deniers that there was no planned, centralized program of annihilation of the Jews by the Nazis. That this whole idea of eliminating the Jews from the European continent and beyond never happened. If you would ask them, "Well, why would the Jews make up this myth?" is that they did it for financial gain and to get the sympathy of the world in order to get a state. That in and of itself makes Holocaust denial a form of anti-Semitism, because the rationale they give to get money and to get a state are, of course, at the center of the stereotypes associated with anti-Semitism. But softcore denial does not deny the Holocaust. There were people who would say, well, of course the Holocaust happened, but was it really 6 million? Of course the Holocaust happened, but were there really gas chambers? I think any thoughtful person today knows that that's a ridiculous kind of thing.
Okay, so that Deborah Lipstadt is a professor at Emory University, one of the world's leading experts on the Holocaust and specifically Holocaust denial. And so it's something that rears its ugly head from time to time. I remember a little over 10 years ago, there was that famous interview between George Stephanopoulos on ABC News and President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, and talking about how it's very common in Middle Eastern countries, in Arabic countries, Middle Eastern countries especially, that have Muslim theocracies, to promote Holocaust denial. And why do they do that? Well, because they are opposed to the nation of Israel. And so this is a cudgel. This is a weapon that they would use to try to delegitimize the nation of Israel, delegitimize the Jewish people. And so you find conferences promoting Holocaust denial in the Middle East, all sorts of things going on there. You also find it among reactionaries in Europe. We'll get to that shortly. But this is part of the interview. And this is Ahmadinejad. He's not invoking that hard denial that Lipstadt's talking about. Like, well, we know this didn't happen. It's, I mean, he may have that view, but I think for an interview, he's coy and he says, well, you know, there's a lot of questions and we're not allowed to ask questions about this. Here's a portion of that interview.
If this is indeed a historical event.
And by the way, that's the translator. Ahmadinejad's speaking probably Farsi or Arabic. That's not his voice, that's the translator.
Why do they want to turn it into a holy thing? And nobody should be allowed to ask any questions about that. Nobody study it, research it. Permitted to research it. Why?
It's the most studied historical event
in history. If this is a historical documented event, why do Western states show so much sensitivity towards a historical event?
Let's talk about what's happening.
They don't want the lid to be taken off.
Let's talk about what's happening right now.
I am asking them to permit studies.
And so notice what he's doing here. He's saying, well, I'm not denying it. And you'll hear this on the internet all the time. It's called the just asking questions approach. It's where you say something like this. I'm no expert, but here's a crazy idea. What if the moon landing was faked and it was done so because reptilian shape-shifting aliens took over the White House and the American government back in the 1960s? I don't know. Maybe. I'm just asking questions. I'm just wondering, is that possible? And so you'll have people who will put forward radical views under the guise of, well, we're just asking questions and why won't people give us a straight answer about this? Now, a good book I would recommend on this subject is by Michael Shermer and Alex Groban, with contributions by Arthur Hertzberg. Shermer is someone, of course, I have a lot of disagreements with. He is an atheist, the former editor of Skeptic magazine, but he still gets, you know, a lot of good work out there on other topics. One of these is this book. It's called Denying History: Who Says the Holocaust Never Happened and Why Do They Say It? So that's a good book I would recommend on this topic. And what's summarized in that book, and you'll see in other resources I'll quote from and go through here in the podcast, is that when people put forward this kind of soft claim, well, I'm just asking questions, no one will give me an answer, why can't we talk about this? Is that, well, no, you have an agenda to try to delegitimize this, and you're failing to recognize, as Deborah Lipstadt said, the Holocaust is probably the most documented genocide in the history of the world. And so those who question it, they're not doing honest history, they have a slant, and so they're ignoring any evidence that is contrary to that slant or bias that they bring forward to this. Okay, so what are the roots of Holocaust denial? Well, the very roots of Holocaust denial go all the way back to World War II itself, while the Holocaust was taking place. When the Nazis realized that the Allied forces, Russia, the United States, were bearing down on them and they were losing the war, when they realized that they were going to lose, they did everything they could to try to destroy records related to the Holocaust so they couldn't be found guilty of war crimes later. So it goes all the way back to even before World War II ended, there was a concerted effort to deny the Holocaust and to cover up evidence. And the Germans did their best, the Nazis did their best to cover up evidence related to the Holocaust, but they couldn't cover up all of the evidence because they were meticulous record keepers. And the murder of 6 million people, 6 million Jews, not to mention millions of other political dissidents, gypsies, Poles, dissenters, Catholic priests who were imprisoned in these concentration camps, you just simply can't cover up all that evidence from survivors, from the gas chambers themselves. There was still plenty of evidence there, and that evidence was discovered by the Allies when they eventually made access and invaded Nazi Germany and other Nazi-occupied areas of Europe. When they finally made headway and liberated these concentration camps, they were shocked by what they saw. So, for example, this is Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander during World War II and future President of the United States. This is what he said. "The same day I saw my first horror camp. It was near the town of Gotha. I have never been able to describe my emotional reactions when I first came face to face with indisputable evidence of Nazi brutality and ruthless disregard of every shred of decency. Up to that time, I had known about it only generally or through secondary sources. I am certain, however, that I have never at any time experienced an equal sense of shock. I visited every nook and cranny of the camp because I felt it my duty to be in a position from then on to testify at first hand about these things in case there ever grew up at home the belief or assumption that the stories of Nazi brutality were just propaganda." Secretary of Defense George Marshall, this was the guy who developed the Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe after World War II, this is what he said. "The visual evidence and the verbal testimony of starvation, cruelty, and bestiality were so overpowering," I believe he means that the Nazis were acting like beasts, "were so overpowering as to leave me a bit sick. In one room where there were piled up 20 or 30 naked men killed by starvation, George Patton would not even enter." This is Patton from World War II. This is the guy, Blood and Guts Patton, you know, think about that movie Patton, like, this is the tough, stern guy. He says, "You don't win wars by dying for your country, you win wars by getting the other guy to die for his country." Patton couldn't even stomach it. He said that he would get sick if he did so. "I made the visit deliberately in order to be in a position to give firsthand evidence of these things if ever in the future there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda." So over the years, there are people who came to deny the Holocaust and to put forward this alternative pseudo-history. In 1974, a British National Front member, Richard Verrill, writing under the pseudonym Richard Harwood, published a pamphlet called Did 6 Million Really Die? The Truth at Last. And then it was promoted by Ernst Zundel, who was another Holocaust denier. So that's a famous one. In 1978, Willis Cardo founded the Institute for Historical Review, which is an organization that promotes Holocaust denial. Other people call it Holocaust revisionism. I think the term Holocaust denial is a better term, though people, what they're going to say is, we're not denying it. We're just saying maybe we don't get all of the facts right, or this fact we don't have right. So it's just an alternative history. So sometimes, yeah, Holocaust denial really does talk about what they're doing, but it's easy for them to say, we don't deny it. We're just saying maybe we don't have all the facts right. So it's a kind of pseudo revisionism. And then in 1993, Deborah Lipstadt, who was writing books on Holocaust denial, was sued by David Irving, a very prominent member of the Holocaust revisionism, Holocaust denial community. And he sued her for libel in England, because in England, it's easier there for someone to sue another person for libel. He claimed that Lipstadt had lied about him, said that he was racist, said that, you know, talking about him denying the Holocaust. And he said that she had defamed his character. And so he sued her for these alleged lies that she put forward in her book. And so this was later dramatized in the 2016 film Denial, with Rachel Weisz taking on the role of Deborah Lipstadt and Timothy Spall as David Irving. It's an awesome movie. It's kind of a slow burn. I mean, it's not an action thriller or anything like that, but it's a wonderful drama piece about this famous trial in the history of the Holocaust denial movement. So I highly recommend that you go and watch the film Denial 2016 with Rachel Weisz. I'm going to play some clips from you. And the film does a good job of dramatizing this kind of combative relationship, this opposition Irving had to Rachel Weisz, which later turned into the lawsuit against her. So they do a great job in the beginning of dramatizing a scene where Irving confronts Weisz at a lecture of hers at a university.
"In your book, why do you continually denigrate the work of David Irving? He's a scholar. He's discovered all sorts of primary sources no one else knew about.
Well, to be honest, I don't think I do denigrate him. Actually, I don't really think about him that much. I don't think he's important. Yes, sir, gentleman in the back.
Professor Lipstadt, let me reveal something to you, Professor. I am that David Irving about whom you have been so rude. Yes, yes, I am he. And it puzzles me that you think yourself qualified to attack me, given that I have 30 years' experience in the archives. And my books have been published by some of the greatest publishing houses in the world. Viking Press, William Morrow, E.P. Dutton. I have to conclude that the reason you don't engage with people you disagree with is because you can't. And you might learn some facts. Facts, Miss Lipstadt, which don't suit your opinions. Well, well.
And so then later on after that, we learn the movie goes on to talk about the libel suit that Irving lodged against Weiss in England that took over 2 years. So she actually assembled kind of a dream team of barristers and researchers to put together evidence to show that, yes, the Holocaust did happen and that David Irving was not merely mistaken, but that he was willfully suppressing evidence and distorting evidence in order to try to advance a false narrative. And so this wasn't just merely a case of, you know, saying, oh, well, he's mistaken or he's wrong. That when you look at the evidence and the pattern of behavior, that Irving was motivated by racism, by anti-Semitism, to distort the historical record to make it seem like that the Holocaust did not happen as mainstream historians believe it did happen. So here's another clip from the film where they show from personal documents from Irving's own diaries that they got his diaries and it's like thousands and thousands of pages for them to go through. Oh, and by the way, it was interesting to see in the movie how the dramatization went when they went through the evidence. Like, what evidence would they use? They decided early on to not call Holocaust survivors to the stand. So they only used primary documents and Irving's own contradictory testimony to make their case. The reason they did that was they did not want, because they thought Irving was going to, you know, represent himself in the case, they did not want him to get these Holocaust survivors in his hands and to berate them on the stand, people who had gone through so much of a traumatic ordeal, that Irving could twist them into a pretzel and say, when you left this gas chamber, was the door on the left or the right? I believe it was on the right. And yet from this schematic we see, it is on the left. You clearly were never here in the first place. So they didn't rely on survivor testimony, but they had more than enough testimony to show the Holocaust did happen and testimony to show that Irving was motivated not out of some kind of sense of historical objectivity, but because he's racist. And so here's a scene from that in the film. So this is where the barrister representing Weiss is reading from Irving's diary to him, asking him what it means.
A quiet evening at home. Jessica. Who is Jessica?
My little infant child.
Yes.
She was 9 months old at the time.
9 months old in September 1994. Jessica is turning into a fine little lady. She sits very upright on an ordinary chair, a product of our regular walks to the bank, I am sure. On those walks, we sing the Binkety Bankety Bong song. She stars in a poem when half-breed children are wheeled past. And then you go into italics. I am a baby Aryan, not Jewish or sectarian. I have no plans to marry an ape or Rastafarian. Racist, Mr. Irving? Anti-Semitic, Mr. Irving?
I do not think so.
Teaching your little child this kind of poison?
Do you think a 9-month-old can understand words spoken in English or any other language?
This poor little child has been taught a racist ditty by her racist and perverted father.
Have you ever read Edward Lear? Hilaire Belloc?
They haven't brought a libel action, Mr. Irving. You have. You sued because you said that we had called you a racist and an extremist.
Yes. But I'm not a racist.
Mr. Irving, look at the words on the page.
And so it's amazing to me that you get to a point when you imbibe such horrible ideas. It's called the banality of evil. You don't really recognize they're evil. And you can't, you just don't recognize, you don't think you're doing anything wrong anymore. It's kind of like Dr. Gosnell. You remember that abortion facility back in Pennsylvania, wherever it was, that he, you know, killed possibly hundreds of infants who were born alive. And when the police raided his home, he was just delightfully playing on the piano and not thinking anything was wrong. I haven't done anything wrong. And he acts like this brutal dismemberments that he was doing. And of course, all abortion providers are engaged in similar disregard for the callous nature of their work. But it's amazing to see that. There's also an exchange later in the film where Irving is on the stand and Richard Rampton, who's played by Tom Wilkinson, he is the, I believe it's a barrister, lawyer, whatever it may be. He's the counsel representing Lipstadt, and he puts Irving on the stand and questions him about Irving's arguments, saying that, well, there weren't really, these aren't gas chambers we see in pictures here on concentration camp schematics and aerial photographs. They're actually air raid shelters. They're bomb shelters. Or in other parts of his book, he says they're places where corpses were gassed to de-louse them, to get lice off corpses. I couldn't find the clip, but I found the script online, and I just love the interplay between the two that I want to read to you. So Rampton says to Irving, "Do you really see a whole lot of heavily armed soldiers running 2.5 to 3 miles from the SS barracks to these cellars at the far end of Birkenau camp?" So it's like they're not air raid shelters because they're 3 miles away from the barracks where the soldiers would supposed to be. They were put far away because they're poison gas facilities. Rampton says, "You see, I'm trying to understand. If there was this dual function, help me. If it's for gassing corpses instead, why would you gas a corpse that's about to go be incinerated anyways?" Then Irving says, "Well, I'm not sure," saying this off the top of my head, "Mr. Rampton. I'm not a Holocaust historian. I'm a Hitler historian." Then Rampton says, "Then why don't you keep your mouth shut about the Holocaust?" And he lets out that little bit of anger to show that Irving doesn't know what he's talking about and that he's deliberately twisting facts in order to promote his anti-Semitic causes. But I'm telling you, even today, there are people who are fans of David Irving because there's a lot of anti-Semitism in the world and especially on the internet. I saw a video of David Irving recently. I don't know if he's alive or not, but recently he was leading tours. He was leading tours of people at a concentration camp, giving his alternative history of these events. And in the comments section under one of those videos, one of the top comments said this: "David Irving is a hero of our time. And the tiny man who put up this video doesn't even remotely have the information or intelligence to debate Irving on any issue." All right, now let's get to the arguments refuting the claims people make in favor of Holocaust denial. One of those claims is the idea that, well, there's no explicit written order from Adolf Hitler authorizing the Holocaust. Well, of course, there's not going to be some kind of blatant, obvious piece of evidence for Hitler and the Nazis to leave behind showing what they were planning to do. But you can piece together evidence to show that this was obviously a part of their mindset and something they knew about during the war. For example, if you read Hitler's earlier work, Mein Kampf, this is what he says. "If at the beginning of the war," and he's talking about World War I, not World War II, "and during the war, 12 or 15,000 of these Hebrew corruptors of the people had been held under poison gas, as happened to hundreds of thousands of our very best German workers in the field, the sacrifice of millions at the front would not have been in vain." So Hitler is saying if we had just gassed a few thousand Jews before World War I, we wouldn't have lost so many German lives in the war. So we see it's on his mindset years earlier. And then during the war itself, we have evidence the Nazis quite well knew and were planning not just to deport Jews from Germany, not just to imprison them, but to exterminate them. This is a clip. This is an actual recording of one of the leading members of the Nazi party, Heinrich Himmler, in a speech he gave at Posen, Poland. A lot of these speeches, there's no shorthand. They don't have the transcripts of the speeches. They were done shorthand, just basic notes, but the speeches themselves were recorded for posterity on wax discs. And this is the Posen speech. I'm going to play a part of it, and then it's in the original German, so I will read the translation along with it, where you see Himmler acknowledging what the Nazis were actually doing. He's saying, "I'm talking about the Jewish evacuation." So first you think, oh, deportation? No, he says exactly what he means by it. He says, "Die Ausrotten der Juden Volkes." That means the extermination of the Jewish people. So I'll go back just a little bit. So he says, "I am talking about the Jewish evacuation, the extermination of the Jewish people."
Meine Juden Evakuierung. Ausrottung des jüdischen Volkes. Es gehört zu den Dingen, die man leicht ausspricht. Das jüdische Volk wird ausgerottet.
It is one of those things that is easily said. The Jewish people is being exterminated.
Sagt Ihnen jeder Parteigenosse. Ganz klar steht in unserem Programm drin. Ausschaltung der Juden, Ausrottung machen wir. Ha! Gleichigkeit.
Every party member will tell you perfectly clear, it's part of our plans. We're eliminating the Jews, exterminating them. Ha, a small matter. This is recorded by Himmler during the war. We know that it's him. And so what Holocaust deniers have to do is they try to say, well, ausrotten doesn't mean exterminate. It just means uproot. So that means to deport. He's talking about deportation. This is called the etymological fallacy. You can't derive the meaning of a word solely by the word, the meaning of the word's constituent parts. For example, the word exterminate, exterminate, it literally means out of borders. But to say I exterminated someone does not mean that you've just simply deported them or moved them. The more common meaning of exterminate is to end the existence of or to kill. And so ausrotten is the same way. In this context, it's referring to extermination, not just deportation. And we also have evidence of this from the Sonderkommandos. These were Jewish prisoners who were forced to operate the gas chambers to kill their fellow prisoners. And we have their testimony. We have the diary of Joseph Goebbels, who was the minister of propaganda for the Nazis. And this is an entry he wrote in March 27, 1942. The procedure is a pretty barbaric one, and not to be described here more definitely. Not much will remain of the Jews. On the whole, it can be said that about 60% of them will have to be liquidated, whereas only 40% can be used for forced labor. So there was a clear plan to exterminate the Jews, and it ended up being about 6 million. So the other one you'll hear is, well, how do we know it was really 6 million? This is from an Israeli newspaper, Haaretz.com. And they say the number was first mentioned by Dr. Wilhelm Hodel, an Austrian-born official in the Third Reich and a trained historian who served in a number of senior positions in the SS. In November 1945, Hodel testified for the prosecution in the Nuremberg trials of accused Nazi war criminals. In the 1961 trial in Israel of Adolf Eichmann, he submitted a lengthy series of questions from the prosecution and spoke under oath from a courtroom in Austria. So we have testimony from him. Yad Vashem, Israel's principal Holocaust Research Center, quotes this and also has surveys collected from survivors noting the millions of people who were killed and puts the number at somewhere between 5 or 6 million Jews that were killed in the Holocaust. Those estimates are also arrived at by using pre-war census data with population estimates made after World War II. So we have more than enough evidence to show the gravity of the situation. Another fact that Holocaust deniers will attack, however, are the gas chambers. They'll say, okay, even if a lot of Jews died in the Holocaust, the Nazis were not gassing people. There's no evidence for gas chambers. It's a myth that was made up after the war. Any gas chambers we do find were only for delousing. It was for killing lice on clothing. They were never used to kill human beings. Well, first, this is actual archival footage we have shot by camp liberators, and it's held in possession of the Department of Defense. This is the footage, and you'll hear the original voiceover describing what the camp liberators saw.
Hanging in orderly rows were the clothes of prisoners who had been suffocated in a lethal gas chamber. They had been persuaded to remove their clothing under the pretext of taking a shower, for which towels and soap were provided. This is the Brausbad, the shower bath. Inside the shower bath, the gas vents. On the ceiling, the dummy shower heads. In the engineer's room, the intake and outlet pipes. Cyanide powder was used to generate the lethal smoke.
Okay, so it's just patently obvious that these were gas chambers. So what Holocaust deniers will say is, yeah, so sure, they're gas chambers, but they were only meant for killing lice, not for killing people. And during the 1980s, Holocaust deniers hired Fred Leuchter to put forward a document to try to prove this that later became known as the Leuchter Report, to try to show that the evidence from the gas chambers, and what he did was he stole parts of the gas chambers to chemically analyze them for the presence of Zyklon B to see how much was present. And he said that there was not enough present there to kill human beings. This was not meant for killing human beings. This is just a de-lousing chamber. So here's a clip from the film Denial, where they go and research the gas chambers, and they're in one of these chambers, and talk about the Leuchter Report.
And this building was used to de-louse the prisoners' clothing. They used Zyklon B for that too, to kill the lice.
We know that?
Yes.
You sure you have proof? I mean, you can't take anything for granted. I need to see the proof.
Yes, I can give you proof. However, in February 1988, a Holocaust denier called Ernst Zundel sent Fred Leuchter, an engineer and self-styled execution expert from America, to test in different parts of the camp for evidence of poison gas in the brickwork. Traces of hydrogen cyanide, HCN. The blue stains here and here.
Came with a chisel.
That's right.
And he hacked away.
Correct.
Illegally, without any permission from the authorities. And then he smuggled the pieces out of Poland in a suitcase wrapped in his dirty underwear.
Be that as it may, we can criticize his methods, but it's his conclusions we have to discredit.
He found higher levels of HCN here in the delousing chambers than he did in the gas chambers themselves. From this, he concluded that no human beings were killed at Auschwitz, only lice were killed.
Why are we talking about Leuchter?
I mean, he's really not worth the paper he's written on.
Well, so you say. Now say why.
I'll tell you why.
Because, of course, there was a higher concentration in here. It takes 20 times more cyanide to kill lice than it does human beings. 20 times! Just Leuchter didn't know that.
God, this whole thing is infuriating.
And so what I love about this scene is that Weiss, who's portraying Lipstadt, a lot of academics will have this mindset of, why are you even talking about these people? We don't want to dignify their response. We shouldn't even be talking about them. But sometimes when you ignore these individuals, people take that as a sign that, not that you choose to not answer them, but that you can't answer them. I hear this all the time. People tell me, why do you engage mythicists, people who say Jesus never existed? It's a kooky view. Just ignore it. Well, a lot of people embrace that view. And so if we don't take it on head on, people will think not that we choose to not answer it, but that we're incapable of doing so. Remember, that is what the charge Irving makes at the beginning of the film in the classroom scene. He says, what I think you say, Professor Lipstadt, is that you don't engage my work because you can't do it. So, once again, I apologize for accents here. I'm not trying to do an accent. I'm trying to do a character voice. I'm doing the best that I can here. So the Leuchter Report was quickly disputed. And there's just so much evidence to show that these really were extermination chambers and gas chambers that were used. And we see with, you know, what Holocaust deniers have to go through. They have to discount the use of the Zyklon B, which they really can't. They try to say that words don't really mean what they mean. And so here we see there's a concerted effort to reach a previous anti-Semitic conclusion rather than to follow the historical evidence where it leads. Here's the last bit of evidence I want to share with you. It is footage from a liberated concentration camp, Birkenau, and it's footage of Lieutenant Jack Taylor. In October 1944, Taylor parachuted into Austria. I don't know why I'm saying Austria, but whatever, to spy on German supply lines. But he was caught by Gestapo agents, sent to the Gestapo headquarters, and then transferred to a concentration camp. Oh, maybe it wasn't Birkenau. It was Mauthausen, not Birkenau. I thought it was Birkenau, but it was Mauthausen or Birkenau, one of them. He was one of the few American inmates in the camp and collected intelligence from fellow inmates regarding the atrocities committed in the camp. Taylor was also part of the slave labor force that built the crematorium used to exterminate the concentration camp prisoners. Suffering from dysentery and starvation, Taylor was scheduled to be executed 4 times, but was saved by fellow inmates who wanted him to survive to report on the camp conditions. Taylor was spared from execution a 5th time when part of the 11th Armored Division liberated the camp on May 5, 1945. Taylor spent his remaining time in Austria collecting documents and interviewing witnesses to gather evidence against the camp commander and guards. And this is from when the camp was liberated. This is the report that he gave.
I'm Lieutenant Senior Grade Jack H. Taylor, U.S. Navy. in Hollywood, California. Believe it or not, this is the first time I've ever been in the movies.
I already knew I liked this guy when he said, I'm Lieutenant Jack Taylor, Hollywood, California. First time I've ever been in the movies. I'm like, you go, America. You tell him, Lieutenant Taylor, what really happened.
I've been working overseas in occupied countries in the Balkans for 18 months. In October 44, I was the first Allied officer to drop into Austria.
And keep in mind, as he's saying this with the sound quality, this is the original recording in 1945 at Mauthausen. And he's standing there in his uniform with probably about a dozen camp inmates and other prisoners behind him. These are the people who worked hard to keep this guy alive so he could say what he's about to say right now.
I was captured December 1st by the Gestapo, severely beaten. Even though I was in uniform, severely beaten and considered as a non-prisoner of war. I was taken to Vienna prison, where I was held for 4 months. When the Russians neared Vienna, I was taken to this Mauthausen concentration lager, an extermination camp, the worst in Germany, where we have been starving and beaten and killed. Fortunately, my turn hadn't come. Two American officers, at least, have been executed here. Here is the insignia of one, a U.S. naval officer. And here is his dog tag. Here is the army officer executed by gas in this locker.
So I appreciate, notice like what he does, like this happened. Here is his dog tags. Here is their medals. Here, these were prisoners of war who had been officers who were executed. And just in their mindset this whole time, we're going to collecting as much evidence as they can in the midst of these atrocities to prove that it really happened.
There were five or six ways by gas.
So he asked, how many ways are they executing people? He says, by gas.
By shooting, by beating, that is, beating with clubs. By exposure, that is, standing out in the snow naked for 48 hours and having cold water thrown on them in the middle of winter. Starvation, dogs, and pushing over a 100-foot cliff. This is all true, has been seen, and is now being recorded.
So after the war, Taylor ended up testifying more about the crimes that the Nazis committed. I think he re-enlisted. He was reactivated in 1946 to serve as a witness in the United States of America versus Hans Altfuldisch. Man, once again, I butcher my British, German, doing the best I can here. According to biographer Patrick O'Donnell, Taylor suffered from symptoms contingent with post-traumatic stress disorder later in his life, and then he ended up dying in a plane crash in May of 1959. But it just shows the courage and heroism of those who recognized barbarism and injustice, and instead of just cracking under the pressure, which would be totally understandable to just completely become catatonic or walk around like a walking ghost, if you will, and lose yourself in that moment and fall into hopelessness and despair and to give up the will to live, which would be understandable in such horrifying conditions. We have heroes like this man and others who fought to survive, to find meaning in what they were doing, and to fight to live in the face of these horrible atrocities. And to do that, for a lot of these people, the meaning was to make sure something like this would never happen again and to tell the world about what happened. And that's why the motto of the Holocaust Museum, the Holocaust, also called the Shoah among Jews, it's referred to more as the Shoah, not as the Holocaust. And the motto of the Holocaust Museum is never again. Never again to let anything like this happen. And so we have to study history and defend history in order to make sure that people learn about these things and that future, because there were other genocides after this. There was the Rwandan genocide. There have been other genocides throughout history that have taken place. And in order to prevent these things from happening, we have to be aware of what human beings are capable of and also be willing to courageously stand up in the face of these sorts of injustices. So if you would like to learn more, once again, a good book on the subject that I recommended earlier is Denying History, Who Says the Holocaust Never Happened and Why Do They Say It? Also the work, Deborah Lipstadt has a book called Denial, Holocaust History on Trial. I think there's another book she wrote called History on Trial, My Day in Court with a Holocaust Denier, that is based on her trial with David Irving. And of course, the film Denial, Rachel Weisz, 2016, another resource I highly recommend. Thank you all for listening to this. I hope it was helpful for you, that you learned a lot, and we'll be back next week with other episodes that I hope will be equally helpful for you all. So thank you guys so much, and have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.